Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Although exact numbers are hard to pinpoint, people have been trying to escape the world's most repressive country, North Korea, for decades, especially since a period of famine in the 1990s. Despite the country's propaganda, the world now has a clearer picture of the horror of North Korea's concentration camps and poverty, because even armed border guards can be bribed, and North Koreans are hungry for information. In her book, Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad, former Wall Street Journal deputy opinion editor Melanie Kirkpatrick describes the hardship of life in North Korea and the difficulty a few lucky residents have had during and after escaping. Melanie Kirkpatrick is senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and she joins us now.
Good to be with you.
Could you describe some of the conditions in North Korea that lead people to want to escape?
You know, I interviewed many people who had escaped from North Korea, and of course, I asked them about what their life was like and why they left. And there's a range of reasons, but I think it's fair to put them under the general rubric of freedom. In some cases, people are fleeing hunger, which indicates a lack of economic freedom in their country, and they're starving. They're either looking for work in China, or they're hoping to hook up with somebody who will help them there. A lot of North Koreans go to China without a plan. They just cross the river and hope that they'll run into somebody who can help them. Another reason they leave is oppression, and that can be for a whole range of reasons. People who get in trouble for saying the wrong thing, or maybe disrespecting the Kim family in some way. And they'll flee, too, because they're afraid that they're going to be arrested and thrown into a prison camp. Others have such horrific experiences in prison camps or detention centers that when they get out, the first thing they want to do is get out of the country. And finally, there are those, and this is the category that's been growing in recent years, there are those who have a sense of what the world is like outside the borders of North Korea, and they have an ambition to get to a place where they can have a better life and more freedom. So in some cases, they have a definite goal in mind of going to South Korea and living there. In other cases, they know they want to get as far as China, which is far freer than North Korea, and then they're not sure what they're going to do next.
You demonstrate that although the country pays lip service to the idea that its residents are allowed freedom of movement under international law, this is generally accepted in countries around the world. North Korea says that's the case. It's really not. So
that's right.
Can you describe the actual, routes or ways that people are able to get out? If, someone decides it's time to leave, what do they do?
Well, the first thing you have to understand is that, like with the Underground Railroad in the American South prior to World War II, the slave, in this case the North Korean slave, has to make a personal decision that he's going to get out and take that first step. And that usually means taking it on his own. And that in a lot of cases, people will find a way to travel from wherever they are in North Korea to the border. And that's not easy, because if you travel outside your hometown, you're supposed to have a permit from the police to allow you to leave where you live. A lot of people are able to bribe officials and, travel around the country, but others just, sneak around and finally reach the border with China. And from there, some of them just take a chance, and they swim across the river, or they wade across it when it's shallow, or in winter they run across the frozen ice. Often they have to bribe a border guard in order to do that. Other times they will hire somebody who lives nearby and can specializes in helping people escape across the border. So I interviewed many people who just literally ran across, and and you know, didn't have to pay those fines. But then I also interviewed people who paid hefty fines or hefty bribes, I should say, to border guards and other security officials in order to turn a blind eye when they were escaping.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly, I mean, the stakes are life and death in North Korea. You can be shot at the border. But even if you make it into China, I believe China is supposed to turn you back over to North Korea, which in a sense is its own death sentence, right?
That's exactly right. China is complicit, and its policy is to track down, arrest, and repatriate North Koreans that they find in China. And when you, as you said, when you repatriate somebody, you're sending them back to a horrific situation, because North Korea severely punishes people who are repatriated from China. And they get even more severe punishment if they are suspected of having, while in China, met with South Koreans or Americans or met up with Christians or been caught in the act of trying to get out of China. So those people are often sent to prison camps for extended stays. The ordinary person goes to another kind of prison, which is a detention center, where conditions are just as bad as they are anyplace else, except their sentence tends to be shorter. But there'll be very little food, there'll be hard labor, and then a lot of physical punishment. The stories I've heard of how people are tortured and physically hurt are terrible. There was one woman, young woman I met, who was repatriated to North Korea from China. And when she was taken from the Chinese by the Chinese police, she was wearing high heels. And 6 months later in the prison camp in North Korea, she was still wearing those high heels. The heels had broken off by then, but and she was very cold too, because she didn't have any proper clothing. And this is typical. Pregnant women are particularly at risk. Any pregnant woman who is returned to North Korea is presumed to have become pregnant by a Chinese man. And she is forced to abort the baby, or if the baby is born, the baby is killed. And the reason for this is that North Koreans the regime is incredibly racist, and it believes in what it calls the purity of the Korean race, and it doesn't want it to be contaminated with what it refers to as Chinese seed.
Now, people have to, as you said before, kind of keep it a secret. And because of that, the Underground Railroad, as it were, leading out of North Korea is kind of closely held information. But as best you can tell, who are the people working to get North Koreans out? And, you know, what is their stake in this?
The Underground Railroad operates mostly in China. That is, once a North Korean reaches China, that's where the helpers are. The rescuers are prepared to hide them, to feed them, and if they wish, help them get out of China. And it operates very much like the Underground Railroad in the United States in the early part of the 19th century. There are individual cells of people who deliberately don't communicate information about every aspect of the route or the safe houses to the other members of the group, because if one person is arrested, he won't be able to divulge information about that would impact the whole operation. So many of the people, there are a couple of categories of helpers. One is brokers or human traffickers, and some of those are very unscrupulous. These people are in it for the money. Some of them are, you know, as honest as the field allows, but they're paid to help people get out. Another group is humanitarians, and these are heavily Christian activists from South Korea and from the United States, working also with Chinese Christians, many of whom are of Korean heritage along the border. And the Christians are there to because of their faith, and they help North Koreans by first providing safe houses for them, and then maybe, you know, offering them some job training. In a number of cases, they're also providing help to women who have been sold as brides to Chinese men and want to escape that, and often sometimes have children, so they help the kids as well. And some of the organizations, the Christian organizations, see themselves as helping North Koreans in place, in situ. They are there for the long term, and these people are at risk of being arrested. So what they do is they will try to bribe a Chinese official to get them residency papers of some sort that would allow them to operate in Chinese society, that is, get a job, get health care, and if they're a child, go to school. In other cases, they hook them up with the people who run the Underground Railroad and help them get out of China. This is very dangerous because it's the usual route is 2,000 or more miles across China to Southeast Asia, where they have to cross another border illegally into a Southeast Asian country. And there are lots of opportunities along the way to be captured. But the Christian operators often work in concert with brokers, and they have developed these routes and rest stops, safe houses along the way with trusted people, and they're getting more people out. A couple of years ago, before Kim Jong-un, the current dictator, took power, about close to 3,000 people were reaching safety in South Korea every year. The last 2 years since Kim Jong-un took over, only about 1,500 have gotten out. And this is in large part, because Kim Jong-un has cracked down very aggressively on the border.
We should just say, by way of clarification, that Christianity is illegal in North Korea. So when the Christians are working kind of along the border, that is flying directly in the face of what the North Korean regime would want.
Well, they're working in China.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. All religion is illegal in North Korea. And people who are found to be practicing religion are very severely punished. And yes, the Christian, the American, South Korean, and Chinese Christians who are helping North Koreans in China are also at risk. And again, China is complicit here. It's against the law to help North Koreans in China. So anybody who helps them is subject to possible arrest in China. And I've tell the story of the stories of various Americans who've been arrested and jailed for helping North Koreans. But China also lets North Korean agents operate freely in China, in its own border area. And these North Korean agents operate outside the law, and they'll do things like kidnap North Koreans and drag them back across the border. And they'll also attack the rescuers. 10 years ago or so, a South Korean who was a resident of the United States, he had a church in Chicago, was kidnapped from the border area, taken to North Korea, and disappeared. It's believed that he died in a camp there.
Mm. You've mentioned this briefly, but in the book, the idea of a third country comes up again and again because, as you say, you know, South Korea, the residents there have a tendency to ostracize the North Korean refugees, and it's not safe in China. So assuming that a North Korean can get into, you know, the U.S. or another part of Asia or Europe, what is life like then?
You know, almost every North Korean who gets out goes to South Korea. The United States has accepted, I think, 176, maybe. A couple of hundred have gone to Europe and Canada. But most of the overwhelming majority of North Koreans want to go to South Korea. And you're correct that there is some animosity or prejudice toward North Koreans in the South for sure. At the same time, I think that's changing, and the younger generation in South Korea is more aware of what's going on in North Korea, and there are a lot of activists now in South Korea, many of them young, who are helping North Koreans there. In addition to that, the South Korean government is extremely generous in providing training and resettlement advice and apartments and jobs for a lot of the North Koreans. The North Koreans have a hard time in the South. Most of them come singly, that is, without any family. And in South Korea is a kind of society where family support is really important. And so these poor North Korean people don't have any kind of community in which who will help them. For example, if you're going to college, typically in South Korea, you live with your family. And North Koreans don't have that. So it makes it doubly difficult for them there. And second, if you think about it, the qualities, the skills that you're taught to succeed in North Korea are exactly the opposite of what you need to succeed in South Korea. In North Korea, any kind of initiative is dangerous because if you speak up, you might say the wrong thing and be arrested and punished. Whereas in South Korea, the 13th largest economy in the world, people who succeed are those who do take initiative and speak up and have their own ideas about how to do things.
The information age has changed the picture in North Korea. Information is being smuggled in and out. There's a great interest in Western entertainment, and there's radio being piped in to North Korea. At the same time, as you've mentioned, the young leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, has been as bellicose as ever and internationally, but domestically has cracked down as well. So I wonder where you see this tension going.
The information invasion is a very powerful it's a very powerful happening. It has the potential to change North Korea. Already you're finding people in North Korea who no longer believe in the power. They're questioning the power of the regime. And this is because they are seeing what's possible in other places around the world. And this happens because once a North Korean leaves North Korea, once he escapes to China or South Korea or wherever, like an immigrant anywhere, the first thing he wants to do is get word home to his family and friends about his new life and that he's okay and tell him what's happening. And these exiles are finding ways to smuggle information into North Korea. Some of them do it through very primitive methods. They'll hire a Chinese courier who could safely go to North Korea, and that courier will knock on the family member's door and orally deliver a message. But there are high-tech means, too, that are becoming very popular. For example, cell phones. Chinese cell phones are smuggled in to North Korea. And if a North Korean uses the phone fairly near the border, he can capture a Chinese cell phone signal and make a phone call or receive a phone call. Now, Kim Jong-un is very worried about that. And he has scanners, where the security forces will go around neighborhoods at night with these scanners trying to find, the radio waves or I'm not a technician, so I may have the wrong knowledge here, the wrong words here, but they can tell when somebody is using the cell phone. And so if they find that person with a cell phone, that's a very serious crime, and he would be punished. So what they will do, what the North Koreans will do, is they'll make a phone call for maybe 10 minutes, and then they will move to another location and make another phone call for 10 minutes. But all of that is having a very big impact in North Korea. The elite people in Pyongyang is a closed city, only the elites can live there. Those people who have access to DVD players, for example, have been able to watch smuggled South Korean soap operas. And I interviewed a young woman from Pyongyang who was a dancer, and some friend of hers had a videotape at the time of a South Korean soap opera, and that was a factor that persuaded this dancer to get out. She said she couldn't believe that the regime in North Korea had been lying to her about the South. She had been told that the South was poor, that there was a lot of crime, that people didn't have enough to eat, et cetera, et cetera. And she saw the soap opera and watched, you know, how well everybody lived. There was food on the table. They got out of their apartments and went to their own private car, and it really changed her outlook.
You conclude by alluding to Gaddafi, who, you know, ruled with an iron fist for decades and seemed impossible to lose his grip on Libya, but ultimately did, and it happened in a hurry.
Yes.
People have been predicting the end of North Korea for a long time. It hasn't happened yet. I guess the question is this sustainable?
You know, people, as you say, have been saying for years that it isn't sustainable, and of course it is. When you have a rule by a mafia don like Kim Jong-un or his father or grandfather before him, all they care about is maintaining power. So they eliminate anybody who they fear is a potential threat to them. Kim Jong-un purged and had his uncle executed at the end of last year because he feared that his uncle was getting, we think the reason was he feared his uncle was getting too close to China. But, you know, I would be foolish to make any prediction about the sustainability of the Kim regime. But I do think that this information invasion is having a potent effect. And one thing has changed in North Korea dramatically over the past 10 or 15 years since people have started escaping. That is that people are skeptical of the regime now. They don't have the confidence that the Kim family is the great father who's going to look after them. And so I think that's a very big difference between, as I said, even 10 years ago. And as the more information gets into North Korea, the more people are educated about the potential in the outside world, the more they're going to call for change, I think. Or you already, when I talk, many of the North Koreans I interviewed point to China and say, look, China 30 years ago, 25 years ago, was like us. And look at how free it is today. Of course, China's not a free country, but it's freer by far than it was 25 years ago. And so North Koreans are increasingly aware of that. And there is no organized dissent there now, but I do think that could come.
Melanie Kirkpatrick is the author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad, published now with a new preface from Encounter Books. It's just been a pleasure to speak with you about the book, and thanks for writing it.
Thanks for talking to me. I enjoyed it.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.